They're both well known for their work as civil rights activists, in addition to their credits on stage, screen, television, and radio. Within the civil rights movement, they're highly regarded for always going out of their way to support causes they believe in with their presence and performances at demonstrations and marches. And as James Farmer, co-founder of the Congress on Racial Equality, said, they became involved with the civil rights movement before it was fashionable. Let me refresh your memory about their performance careers. Ossie Davis appeared on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun, Green Pastures, and Pearly Victorious, which he also wrote. Pearly Victorious was later adapted into the musical Pearly, which starred Ben Vereen on Broadway. Davis was one of the first black directors in the film industry. He's directed Cotton Comes to Harlem, Congee's Harvest, Black Girl, Gordon's War, and Gone Are the Days, which was adopted from his play Pearly Victorious. On television, he's appeared in Roots, The Next Generation, received an Emmy nomination for his portrayal of Martin Luther King Sr. in the made-for-TV movie King. He wrote the screenplay for the public television American Playhouse production For Us the Living, based on the life of Medgar Evers. With Ruby Dee, he co-hosted the public television series Ossie and Ruby. Ruby Dee's film roles include Ruth in A Raisin in the Sun, Lutiebell in Gone Are the Days, and Ruth in Buck and the Preacher. On stage, she's performed in Pearly Victorious, won an Obie for her role in Bozeman and Lena by Ethel Fugard, and received the Drama Desk Award for her role in Wedding Band. On television, she's appeared in All God's Children, Roots, The Next Generation, Maya Angelou's memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, It's Good to Be Alive, which was the Roy Campanella story, and To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, writings from Lorraine Hansberry. Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee are in Philadelphia as the guests of honor at tonight's 10th anniversary celebration of the Philadelphia Miniversity. The Miniversity is a community educational facility geared to adults, offering 12-week courses. And for more information about the Miniversity or their 10th anniversary ball, you can call 765-2815. That's 765-2815. And I want to thank you both for being here and welcome both of you to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Okay. It's a pleasure to be here to sit and talk with you.
A lot of credits to get through, and that's with Eddie.
But you know, when you said Ben Vereen was in Pearly, I began to. Was Ben Vereen in Pearly?
No,
that was
Cleavon Little. But they both will understand.
Yes.
They're friends and lovers of each other.
What am I confusing that with then?
Ben Vereen was in
Pippin.
Pippin.
It was Pippin I'm thinking of.
And Jesus Christ Superstar, I think he mm-hmm.
Okay,
also
I was imagining him in Pippin. Well,
but you know,
I apologize for that mistake.
But you know, Terry, as I listen to all of that stuff being read back, and I say to myself, now, why is that necessary? And I suppose all those things validate the fact that you can claim some time of the claim some of America's attention. You get on the radio, and because you've got all those credits, people are going to listen to what you have to say. I wonder if they would listen if none of that stuff was true. Would they still listen just to me? What do you think?
I think they would, but the reason why I give a lot of credits is so that people can say, that's right. I remember that.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
seen that.
Well, I don't
yes,
mind.
Right, yes, because
I like when I'm listening to somebody, I like to know that they what's happening. I meant to tell Grace Sullivan, by the way, whose guests we are. We've been invited to the mini university anniversary. That this today is our anniversary too.
Wedding anniversary.
And I forgot about it until this morning.
Oh, how
this
nice!
Ready to leave,
isn't
and
it wonderful?
Ossie remembered. You know how it is. You know, some women always
isn't
remember
it,
these things.
Like, isn't it, darling?
Happy anniversary!
Thank you very much.
Did you meet on stage?
Literally.
Yeah,
well, I was on stage, you were
rehearsal.
In the audience, but in rehearsal we met.
We met in rehearsal for Jeb. That was my second show, which I started out as an understudy. And I wound up playing the lead in this one with Jeb, with Ossie.
Mm-hmm. Did you have one of those relationships where you were having a relationship in the play that you were in and that led to the real thing?
We were lovers in the play, but I don't know how we got to be lovers.
Weren't in because when I first saw him, I used to sit with the actor Bill Marshall, who was covering for him, and we used to sit and make
handsome
fun of him because
dough.
He looked so he looked like he just come out of a junkyard, you know, where he got dressed and come to the rehearsal. We used to talk about him terribly, make fun of him and everything. You know how young people can be.
Little did you know, right?
Little did I know that I would come to appreciate this love.
Let that be a lesson to you. My first professional appearance on any stage anywhere was at the Locust in Jeb. Remember?
Right here in Philadelphia.
Yeah. So I have great affectionate memories of this great city.
and scary ones too. One of the, you know, racism rarely affects me, you know, having grown up in the North. I was born in Cleveland. I mean, not in the obvious ways, like you have to dress in, you know, water fountains and all that kind of thing that was traditional. But I never will forget, I was very ill. I got ill. I was sick for one of the very few times in my life right here in Philadelphia during Jeb. And in a hotel, I don't remember it. I caught an awful cold. And Ossie had come to see me. I scarcely knew him, didn't know him that well. And he wanted to come to see me. And the people in the hotel didn't want to let him up. Remember that, Ossie?
Mm-hmm.
But you finally did get up, didn't you?
I think so. I wondered what this young scoundrel was doing looking for to come visit a lady in a hotel room.
I guess it was something peculiar like that, and that's the only thing that ever that ever happened to me.
I forgot all about
and,
that.
And suddenly I felt so guilty of something, and when I wasn't really guilty of anything, but as I pieced it all together, you know.
Did you find you have different views of things when you first started going together? Since you, Ruby Dee, were from the North, and you, Ossie Davis, were from the South, did you have pretty different views of the way things operated in the country, or, you know, about what needed to be done?
We had different views. We still have different views now. But I don't think our views ever made us enemies or was something that we needed to fight each other about. I thought that she was looked at things in a rather weird light, and I think she thought I looked at things in a rather weird light.
Because I thought he came back from behind the plow or something, you know, when in truth he had really wasn't a farm boy at all. He read books and things like that. And was
No, but I don't know if I'm the kind of person who ever meets people with whom I am in total and violent disagreement. I mean, there are people whose ideologies and philosophies, you know, differ markedly from mine, but I never seem to meet them in person. And I met Ruby, I liked her, and as an actor, as a friend, and eventually, all things being equal, we wound up being married, and that didn't hurt things either. But I don't think we ever threw things at each other.
No.
Certainly not aiming to hit, right?
Not aiming to hit, that's right.
Yeah.
At what point in your performance careers did civil rights activism and your career on stage start to intersect?
Well, may I speak to that first, ma'am?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, I think it happened in two layers. First, when I came to New York in 1939 and got a job in the Garment Center, there was a lot of activity going on at that time because in 1939, Europe had gone to war. The thing about Hitler had taken place. Mussolini was rampant. Haile Selassie was run out of the country. And as a kid in high school, as a young college man, I had been involved, as young folks were, in all of those activities. So when I came to New York, you know, I was still involved in all the things that went on. After the war, coming back from overseas, and getting a job in the theater, I remember a specific occasion when a young returning veteran coming back to North Carolina, I think his name was Isaac Woodard, and he had an altercation with a bus driver, and the sheriff gouged out his eyes. It was a horrible case. And there was a benefits and protest rallies given in the theater. And I became involved in that kind of thing, and there was always something. Rosalie Ingram, the Monroe people, the two fellows from Freeport, Long Island, something was always happening. And the theater at that time was one of those places where a group of people who cared always had something going. Robeson was around, Canada Lee was around, Jane White, Will Gear, or actors whose names I forget now. But it seemed natural that seemed to be a part of what the theater was all about. So I just became involved long before the 1954 Supreme Court decision. And Ruby also was.
I mean, I don't even remember it like a starting date or starting time. It seems as if, you know, the political atmosphere, what happened to black people was part of the warp and woof. Is that right, warp and woof?
Mm-hmm.
anyway, woofing at the warp that racism gives rise to. I can't remember being apart from it as early as my first remembrance of being on a stage is in connection with some rally having to do with rights in Harlem. Adam Clayton Powell took me by the hand and brought me up. I remember being a very little girl saying a poem or something. I haven't been apart from it, and of course it's broadened in terms of because it and it's deepened because not only does it lend a kind of depth and consciousness to what you do, but how you do it. I mean, it's part of the kind of artist performer you are, and I mean, I wouldn't recommend it necessarily for depth. I don't think it's a requisite.
What?
Racism is a requisite for profundity.
No.
Or anything like that. But it does connect with the total human condition. So maybe it was in preparation for just being a whole human being that one is born connected to very real human dilemmas and also joys and special reactions in this world.
You know, it may be, Terry, that for some groups at some time, struggle is a part of the very culture, you know, which defines them. You're born into it, you live through it, and you bequeath it to your children when you die. I never was aware that I had the option not to be involved.
That's right.
You know, or that there was a way of life that went this way, and when I was feeling extra good, I could stop and do something good for somebody. It seemed to come to me a part of the joy of living and the sorrow of living and the responsibilities of living and what you owed to others and what the society owed to you. It was all mixed up into one ball.
But as an adolescent, though, I do recall thinking I could be a starlet in Hollywood, you know, and sign on with the MGM and do grade B movies and learn my craft.
You really thought that?
You know, be in the stable with the people, you know. Yes, I used to think about things like that. When Arlington Spangler Brew, you know, Robert Taylor was my idol, and all those kinds of things. Because I remember going through that, and it was a while before I don't remember when exactly I realized that my life. I would never be a starlet in Hollywood. You know what I mean? I think
did it hurt you when you found out?
Did it hurt me?
Did it break your little heart?
Well, I don't really know, but because by then I had met people like Dick Campbell and the Rose McClendon Players, and I'd joined the American Negro Theater, and I was going other things in life. And I had written letters to Hollywood. And I said, well, if I can't be an actress, well, then I'll join Walt Disney, and I'll be a cartoonist, and I'll draw Mickey Mouse. I'll be one of the artists that do those, you know, things, because I could draw and paint and stuff. And
did they answer your letter?
No, I never got an answer. But I never got an answer from them. But circumstances, you know, divine circumstances, a way of answering our longings and putting us in, directing us in paths. And then, you see, we didn't have Richard Roundtree's and Sidney Poitier and Billy Dee Williams and all those handsome men to admire in the movie magazines.
Mm-hmm.
So when you stole a look at one of those and you saw what was wonderful seemed apart from you, but it was really when you were very young, growing up in a quote integrated circumstance. That's one advantage, I think, of being in the South. You get a look at beauty and standards and values that are more closely connected to you.
What roles would have been open to you in Hollywood when you were coming of age as an actress?
Well,
Amanda Jane.
Yeah, maids and parts like that. My first role in television was as a maid, and so I never tire of telling this story about Arthur Hanna, who used to head up Place not too far from here. He was the director of Nora Drake, and he also taught at the American Academy of Dramatic Art, where I had a scholarship, and we were learning how to give auditions, and again, I can't pinpoint the time, but I had picked all this material that, although I could do accents, you know, Russian, French, Spanish, German, African, all kinds of things. But I chose for my audition material, you know, all the black dialect things, all the made characters, stereotype things that I'd heard already on radio, and I proceeded to pattern my audition just on those on the order of things that I thought I would get that he might see fit to cast me in. So I never will forget he had me stay after class. Arthur Hanna, his beautiful white hair, and I couldn't imagine. I thought, well, maybe he's going to give me a job or something. You know, I couldn't imagine he was going to. So after everybody had gone, he called me and he said to them, you must never do that again. I said, do what? You know, I wasn't clear, but the upshot of it was, I don't remember the words exactly what, exactly. Never, don't play, he said, don't play me cheap is what he was saying. I know you can do more than you, that kind of material that you did for your audition. Somehow I had degraded him mm-hmm. by appealing to his, racist concept of myself. And he said, you must always try to do the best you can do and what you want to do. And that stuck with me a very long, long time. In other words, one must always be true to the best of oneself, and mm-hmm. And let the chips fall where they may. And I've since learned that too. And I repeat it here because sometimes when a way doesn't seem open to you, but if you stick with it and trust and believe, and it's part of what you're supposed to be doing with your life, the way will open. Mm-hmm. And I just had to say that because I've heard kids, young people who get discouraged by what is, and without considering what will and must mm-hmm. be.
They don't give themselves the benefit of the doubt.
That's right. And it's hard to struggle against odds when you don't see where the openings are.
Mm-hmm. What kind of roles were open to you, Elsie Davis, when you were coming of age and wanted to work either in film or on stage?
Can I just finish this by saying mm-hmm. Arthur Hanna eventually did give me a job on his show, Nora Drake.
So all of it was justified?
No, not well, justified. But
well,
you know.
Terry, I don't know. I was not ever one who seriously considered myself as an actor. I always wanted to do something else, so I wasn't measuring what the opportunities were out there as an actor. But as I think back, all that was available, if I remember correctly, you know, was Servants, once again, or the stereotypical kinds of things. America was not yet at that time ready to look at black folks in the way that America is prepared to look at us now, or we were not then a part of the great rainbow coalition that we hear eloquently spelled out now. And but for me, it wasn't so much a personal put down because I always wanted to be a writer, not an actor. I wasn't looking for those particular kinds of jobs. I was lucky. I got jobs as an actor, and that paid the bills. But I was measuring what happened to me as a writer. Now, the thing, for writers, the limits were even much more stringent. You know, there were no places where plays about blacks, certainly by blacks, were being done except in those places that we came from. I came from the Rosenblatt Players in Harlem. Ruby came from the American Negro Theater in Harlem. We looked at what was there and what was not there, and we were insulted and we were hurt. But also we had a culture which sustained us. We had a way of life that was rich and fulfilling. The music that I used to go to the Apollo and listen to did a certain thing to me that made me somewhat impervious to the other things, the things I got in churches and neighborhoods and friends and things. An exceedingly rich life was available to me, so that I never felt that my tender emotions were exposed, and when I reached out to grab the great American brass ring and they knocked my fingers down and I was a hurt little black boy standing in the corner. I never believed that in the first place. I had been prepared, I suppose. Certainly growing up in the South, you're prepared for segregation and prejudice because it confronts you. So I saw the parts that were there, a step and fetch it, the young lady who, Hattie McDaniel, some other very, Clarence Muse, some very good performers were there. But
there were concepts that were written by whites, you know. The black mm-hmm. writers had, were really neglected on the Hollywood scene and still are in the, you know, to a large extent. But talking about feeling left out, when one sees the body of work coming from black writers in this country, right,
mm-hmm.
Ossie?
Mm-hmm.
you realize... I suddenly, that was all I wanted to be about. That's what I want to be about now. Because to spend my life exploring those works of people that I come to love and admire and try to emulate. One of them is right here, Sonia Sanchez in Philadelphia.
Yes.
She taught me about poetry and rhythm and song and music and all going together. Let alone Pauline Marshall and Rosa Guy and Alice Walker and Childress and Killens and Williams, many, many, in addition to the traditional ones that we've come to respect.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is very exciting prospect.
And what are you
going to
do
future.
With all those writers?
Huh?
What are you going to do with all those writers?
You know, Ossie, we're trying as hard as we can in many years of our lives to, you know, to make our poets as well known as the baseball players and musicians and, you know the popular singers and because we think they are to the world of music, I mean to the world of thought, black writers are.
Mm-hmm.
As black music is to the world of music, there's a freshness and a vigor there I think we have to pay attention to it because, you know, as a nation, all of us, no matter what color we are going through a strange and psychic debilitation. And I think that the black writers offer a source of energy and sustenance that we really have to look into as a country and as a people.
You know what I'd like to do, Terry and Ruby? I'd like to shift gears just a little
mm-hmm.
and bring to the Fresh Air audience a little information about what it is we're here for.
Yes.
It has to do with being described as, say, the guest of honor. It has to do with being described as celebrities. It has to do with being described as people who live and work in motion pictures. What are we in Philadelphia for? Two people we know, Leon Sullivan and Grace Sullivan, people we know, admire, and love.
The Reverend Dr. Leon Sullivan.
But he's my neighbor, so I don't call him all those titles.
Okay.
So a neighbor is involved in something, and because the neighbor is meaningful to you, you want to be involved in that same thing on that same kind of level. I think we were lucky in that we always tried to remember that. We met during our lives many people who were considered great leaders, great public figures. We mentioned Robeson before, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and various people. But always we managed to relate to them as neighbors or as friends or as somebody who was doing something. He said, hey, he's doing something good, so why don't you run over and give him a hand on the basis that if you were doing something good, he will come over and give you a hand.
We need Grace, each other so desperately.
Yeah, you know, this is only one of the things that Leon Sullivan and Grace Sullivan insist on doing. And it's a good thing, and we are honored that they invite us to come over as their friends, as their guests, you know. And we sit down, we break bread together, we have a 10th anniversary of the mini-versity, we talk to each other. And it's good. It's like being back with the family after you haven't seen them in a long time. So it's a fulfilling thing to us. We're not guests who jet in just for this occasion, you know, and sit around the cold mm-hmm. hotel room. No, these are friends, and we come to see what they're up to, and we see, and we're happy to be here.
And we didn't jet anywhere. We came on the train, you know, and I just love riding on the train. I just have to tell you that, Terry. You didn't ask me, but
you probably read on the train, right?
Well, I haven't ridden taken a trip on the train. Mm-hmm. And just as I was getting settled for this lovely, soothing ride,
you were here.
To get off, you know. I remember years ago, we only went to California by train. 4 days it took us.
Five,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since you mentioned the Miniversity, let me give the phone number if people want to find out more about the Miniversity
Good.
Or about the 10th
Good.
Anniversary celebration this evening. It's 765-2815. And my guests are Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. I think for anyone who's interested in either political art or really good art. It's not always the stuff that enters the mainstream. You know, like the best literature isn't necessarily the best sellers, mm-hmm. and the best scripts aren't necessarily the ones that actually get produced in the movies, and the most provocative scripts aren't necessarily the ones that actually sell tickets on Broadway. Mm-hmm. How have you balanced your careers between what you thought was really of value and what you needed to do in order to just like make a name for yourself in the field and make a living at your profession as well? Because I think it's something that every artist has to confront during their career.
Mm-hmm. Well, to tell you the truth, all I can think of now is I hope I have enough time left in my life to be about, you know, the writer's works I'd like to be about. I remember, you know, it's not usual, I'm sure, but all actors receive a lot of material, and I've been offered scripts over the years, and for one reason or another, I couldn't take them. Either I was having a baby or something, or I didn't like the script or I didn't care. But now, as I look back on it, I questioned my judgment from time at times, because no matter what that script was, it was one more step in the direction of what I really want to do now, and that's experience in getting those works, putting those works on myself. We have a production company now, producing works, and being closer more constantly to how it's all done. It's not necessary to have great respect every role you take. As an actor, you know, as long as it doesn't insult you, your intelligence, or humanity, people, black people, or any people in general, you know, it's a job that prepares you for the future.
No, I think you're saying a special thing.
Oh, I'm missing the. I think I've missed the point.
No. Yeah. It's your point, so you didn't miss it. But I'd like to point out something that you didn't stress nearly enough. Mm-hmm. I think that there are roles and there are plays that are abominable, and you know that the script should be sanitized and put on the garbage truck and taken away. What you are saying is that although a work may come in that is dreadful and abominable, it may be that way because the author doesn't know or is not tuned into his material. It's not because the author is a racist or he hates people. He may misperceive what he's trying to deal with, and that is very true when people are dealing with black material. Mm-hmm. So what Ruby is trying to say, I believe, is that it was incumbent on us not to just turn things down, but to explain why, and mm-hmm. sometimes to tell the author how he might or she might have made it better
to participate something. In the process.
You see, Ruby was just in a thing, a film.
Yes, yeah, well, yes. Well, I'm not going to talk about that now. But at first, it was something I didn't want to do. And then, because the author was a good friend of mine, and so too little material is done by really fine authors. And so, I don't have time, you know. And then I said, oh yes, I do have time. This man is my friend. I think he's a genius of a writer, and I'm going to be part of this, if it's only two words. And of course, for my part of my payment. Which these days is that I must be listened to. You know, you have to really listen to my perspective here. And indeed, I was listened to, and I felt that it was all worth the effort and the time, and I felt we had a good exchange with the producers and the director, people responsible for getting it on. That's what I mean about backing away. And we can't afford to look down our noses at material or be so angry because black writers aren't included that we don't participate in the selections, because not only is this true of black people in terms of the material that's being done, some fine work is being done, make no mistake, in film and on television, but most of it isn't that fine about women, about people over the world, you know, about things that if the purpose of art is to affect change, well, it's sliding in its responsibility. I mean, you know, art can unite people. Art can make the people of the world, not the governments, but the people themselves coming together and, you know, forging a better life, that kind of responsibility.
I thought one of the things you were also saying before was that even though a role might not be great, or the film or stage production might not be great, there's a lot that you can learn from participating in something.
Yes,
that isn't all that great. But on the other hand, then you have all these people judging you based on what the script was, and even though you didn't write it, and even though you didn't think it was great, do you run that risk that you'll somehow be misinterpreted through your presence in it?
Well, yes, you run that risk. Mm-hmm. You do. But you do the best you can, and you contribute what you can, and you learn what you can, and you move on, because the circumstances of getting going in this business are not idealistic, are not ideal, you know, in terms of philosophy or talent.
Mm-hmm. You have a production company now?
Yeah, we have a production company, which we call Emmeline 2. I forget what Emmeline 1 was, but Emmeline 2 is a production company. The thing that we've done of most moment was 26 half-hour shows that we did over a period of 2 years out of Dallas, Texas, with KERA TV. We've co-produced with Bill Moyes that's going to be on the air in a short while. We have several other things that we've done.
With the Corporation for Entertainment and Learning.
Right. And mm-hmm. and we feel that this is our way, this is our responsibility. This enables us to stand side by side with the people for whom and with whom we work, and to insist on making input or feeding something into the process and accepting some of the responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to be an actor, but an actor is a very, very tenuous situation. It's like a leaf on a tree. You cut the connection, you know, and the leaf is gone. The tree will remain. We want to be one of the branches, so that even if the leaves did fall, you know, we would still be there.
Yes, and also we realize that it's so much more than just the perform. You have to build a structure, and we feel that the structure is built on the back of the writer. You know, that's our perspective. Mm-hmm. And having believed that for so many years, we almost had to get into production because, you know, it's even in terms of songs. The people who own the company write the songs. The people who do the television, they hire somebody to write what they want into formula. And so the great writers of our time get left behind. I mean, blacks, surely, but a lot of other whites or oriental. I mean, the great literature of the world doesn't get touched. I'm not saying our company is going to touch, get an opportunity. But we're hoping, we're going to try, mm-hmm. and we've made a start.
There's another equally profound reason why we are independent producers. One of the characteristics of American society is that we describe things in business terms. You know, the business of America is business. Mm. Our young people need to believe that they can succeed in business, because that's one way by which America judges people, by business. Emmeline 2 is a business. We're in it for profit, but profit is only the smallest consideration. What we're really in it for is to be able to establish control over what we do, how we do it, and over that material which comes from us, which appeals to the people whom we represent. It is not enough for any group or an individual to be always dependent on some other means to get your message or your connections to your own people across. Mm. You must develop the capacity to do it yourself.
Yes, you know? To be as mother, father, parents. You know, you have to be responsible for those images. You have to do something to help the strengthen connections. And we feel that black people too are in a connection crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, the distractions are enormous, and the emphases on what's important in this life is getting all cockeyed. And some people in the world but black people surely, because we know what the problem is. Unfortunately, we wish very much that white people in America understood the depth of the problem that affects them. We tend, as white people, I think white people tend to point to them and their problem and outside, not realizing that what happens at the very lowest level that you permit to happen eventually will happen to you. I mean, we permit, in a sense, the Holocaust. We permit slavery. We have permitted the Japanese, the bombing of Hiroshima and so forth. We permit the the genocide of a people by all these ways. And if we look, it's just like I think of the book The Godfather, you know, was said, well, you stop the drugs in Harlem because, you know, they chased the aristocracy, the black aristocracy, the leadership aside. And there was nobody there to protect these people, so you can get away with it. But now drugs is a problem of this whole country, where it was, so the process of demoralization might start with one group, but it's like a plague; it spreads, and it sucks at the vitality of the spiritual and the. The powers of a nation.
There are other ramifications too, if I may, to that particular thing. A paradigm might be expressed in this form. What happens to the blacks in any particular sense will happen to the rest of the country in 10 or 20 years. For example, now this is an oversimplification, but I use it to make a point. We have, for the last 20 or 30 years, always had a double amount of unemployment in the black community. If the general unemployment rate was 4%, blacks would always have 8%. If it was 5%, blacks would always have 10%. Now, there's a specific reason why the black community is twice as unemployed as the community at large. But if we look at the black community and we say, oh, they're shiftless, they're lazy, they're no good, they don't want to work, then we miss the point entirely. Because we are powerless and defenseless, certain things happen to us first.
We're not powerless and defenseless. I'll take you up on that later.
Okay, but we are powerless and defenseless. Hold your point. Things happen to us before they happen to the others. Now we're beginning to see that double-digit unemployment rate that used to be common for black folks is gradually becoming common for the total American economy. And when it does, we will understand what was happening to black folks way back there, which was simply this. There was a time when out of every four jobs in the black community, three were in the unskilled department. Now, when mechanization and automation came in, the first targets were those unskilled jobs that blacks had been using to support their families for years. Because those jobs were taken away, and nothing was created in its turn, our unemployment rate went gradually up and stayed up because nothing happened. Now we see with robotization, with automation happening in Detroit and other workplaces, the white community begins to say, hey, hold on, that's happening to me. And we say, of course it's happening to you. We tried to say a long time ago that this is the way the economy is going. So that is only one example of how our experience to some degree could be looked upon as a weather vane for what's going to happen to the larger community.
I'm struck with this phrase, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. And what's bad for black people is really bad for the country. You can believe that, you know what I mean?
You better believe you're
better
right.
Believe that.
Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis are my guests. Well, I'm sure that throughout your careers people have told you, well, sure that's a great script, but it won't sell. And, you know, as a producer,
oh,
I really
Lord,
have to think about
yes.
what's going to sell. So now you're in the position of trying to do something that's going to be both profitable and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say it's hard to combine those two. Have you been having success doing things that you can really conceptually back and monetarily back at the same time?
Not yet, but we will.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. That's Ossie's province. But I have to spend the rest of my life doing the things that I believe in. And I have to let somebody else figure out how they're going to make money on it. But I do believe that people are readier to respond to the things that... Because everywhere we've been in the 20 years, people... We do readings. We present material, authors mostly, that we've tried to introduce writers. And people say, well, where can I get that? And the enthusiasm is tremendous for the work of these writers. They've just been denied. I think we have to make up our mind to stop pandering to the worst and the least in ourselves. We got to start trying to stretch out. Some very good films, for example, make money, and some very good television material makes money. I mean, that's also well done and meaningful and you know, not everything is made to formula, like a Star Wars and all those things. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I think it's possible. And when in putting the pieces together, that's the aspect of the company that I want to take care of. Not doing, I don't know from commercial. It hasn't affected me that much all these years.
Well, it is possible, and somebody has to know from commercial, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
One of the problems that we suffer from in the black or the minority community is that we don't have, as a continuing resource, those people or those institutions who can help us with purely business problems. A part of the problem of motion picture production and exhibition is purely and simply the problem of marketing. How do you market a product once you make it? We, for instance, have been involved in things which we made. They weren't the greatest in the world, but they were good. They were good enough to have made their money back had we known how to market the product and get it to the people for whom it was made who were hungry to have it. We need to concentrate not nearly so much on making motion pictures as on marketing motion pictures. And for us to hold up our noses at that and to say we're great artists and we're soul folks, we haven't got time to do that.
Ozzie, did I give you the impression that
No. By no
means,
Ruby.
But I frankly do want somebody to say, Ruby, here, how many million you need for this? Here, there it is. You wanted to do that? You wanted to do this?
Ruby,
right?
If I had the money.
Go do it.
I'll give you an IOU right now. I mean, I'll give you an IOU.
At this time in my life, I'm expecting that. Miracles.
No, but the question that Terry asked, has to be looked at in its broadest sense before you can really give an intelligent answer to it. Because it, once again, it's not us alone who is having problems with the kind of representation that we get in Hollywood, women in particular, the other minorities, so forth. But now a part of that is racism and sexism and pure prejudice and maleism and all that sort of thing. But also an equally important part is that the American way of doing business is based on mass production, which is to produce something that appeals to everybody. Therefore, those things which are too specifically catered, tailored for one particular group, will tend not to sell because everybody says, oh, that's for the Jews, or that's for the Irish, or that's for the Polacks, or that's for the blacks. We don't want to go to that. Therefore, Hollywood, as a business institution, will say, what we need is something that we can put a little piece of Polish in, a little piece of Jewish, and a little stick of black, and a little piece of woman in there, and everybody will come and say, wow, there's something in this for me. Now, unfortunately, that leaves out all of those things which have value, which cannot be translated into dollars and cents.
And it tends to trivialize our existence.
It does.
And you see,
but
we have
to find a way to deal and go around the trivialization.
Well, it's all, you know, nothing happens in isolation. It's all connected with the political, you know, the whole picture needs an overhaul, you know. Mm. I think we need to have another constitutional convention, get back to basics, you know, reprint the Constitution, hand out flyers, then the Bill of Rights and say, now look, this is what we're about. Let's go from here, fellas. And also, you know, we have to pay a few more radicals because Jesse Jackson is just not, he can't do it by himself, raising all the hard, ugly questions, you know, and that are very meaningful to, you know.
I think it's a good idea.
So
here
it's
we
all
are
connected.
In Philadelphia, it happened, what, in 1789 or something, when they cracked the Liberty Bell and all that stuff. You want to have one while we're here, another constitutional convention.
Well, I think we really
need a new meeting
here because nothing the cultural picture won't change. I was sitting here talking about things and we're here for a reason. I realize that, but enough people saying, well, hey, with this concept, these rights are being stolen away from us bit by bit. And also culturally, the culture has to interface with the government, political, with the, you know.
Well, there's another question here, which is we know that, like, really bad art that trivializes things can be really offensive and perpetuate stereotypes and dumb notions. But do you think that good art is a profound source of change? You know, do you believe in the power of art to change the culture?
I believe in the power of art to change the culture, but not on a one-to-one basis. I don't think that the function of art has a direct responsibility to go out and upgrade and to clean the communities, to have health, to do all of those things which other institutions do. But I believe that when art does serve its function and brings beauty to as many people as possible, the effect of its effect on the people involved will cause the people to change their perceptions. And when people change their perception, they change their activities to respond. There was a time in the 60s or before the 60s when the black community did not like the word black. We'd been conditioned and programmed to think that black was bad, and if we called a brother black, that was something to fight about. Now, through art, through agitation, through discussion, through music, through painting, through dance, through plays, the whole word black, the whole concept black, came to have a totally diametrical meaning to what it had previously had. And we went out and we embraced it, and we looked upon ourselves in a different light. And because we did, we helped the rest of the world to look upon us in a different light. And then we said, black is beautiful. And the words say, yeah, man, right on.
But we're in the kindergarten of this contemplation, you understand, even this discussion here. Because you listen to me, it sounds like I'm some authority, but because I think the creative process is the closest thing to a divine process, you know, that a mankind has come upon. I think it's profoundly effective in terms of changing our concepts and widening our consciousness and bringing us closer to a new kind of value system that we are on the verge of now. You know,
now art has a responsibility in creating new value systems. For instance, I seldom use the word mankind anymore. I say humankind
because did I say mankind?
You said mankind, but we love you for it, but we understand.
But I don't mind mankind, you know.
It's limited now, you know. Our consciousness has been raised, and I think
it's been shaken because it really doesn't matter that much.
I think it matters until we make the changes which will make it not matter.
That's what I'm saying. You know, there you go.
We have to keep watch.
You've performed in a lot of different arenas, I mean, including, like, movies, TV, radio, stage. You've also performed at marches and demonstrations. You've done readings, given speeches. What kind of material do you use in a context like that? And how do you see your role there as performer at a demonstration? And in what ways do you try to connect through your material?
Well, I'm frankly happiest when we found something that crystallizes why we have come to this place and what this is all about and its possible meaning in our lives, you know. When we put it in some kind of context through what we do, I'm happiest then.
Mm-hmm. It depends a great deal on what the actual context of the rally or the meeting will be. Sometimes a rally will go on forever, and there's so many speakers that people are getting tired. So you then must come in with something that changes the scene. Or there'll be a lot of musicians and they will be gigging with each other and none will ever get off the stage. So that when you get on, then you must try and go in a different direction. It depends upon what will give the audience a new sense of purpose. And if the purpose of the rally is stated and if it's articulated and everybody speaks about it, then you don't get up and do the same thing. You get up and do a funny poem or a sad poem or a touching poem. You may not even mention the subject at issue because everybody else mentions the subject at issue. And you might just get up and tell a funny joke or something like that. And the audience is tremendously relieved, and you will have done your duty. You don't have to raise the flag every time. You know, we look upon ourselves as artists as sort of servicing the communications needs of the leadership and the philosophy which we embrace that represents what our community or our group or our nation or our is all about. And we become sensitive to that from experience. So Ruby and I will sit, and while we're waiting to be called upon, we'll say, Ruby, let's not do this poem, let's do that one, or let's not do a poem at all. Or let's just get up and take a bow.
Or let's tell a story. Or do a dialogue.
So that we don't go to the place with an ideological commitment that we must honor by getting up to make a rousing speech against the evil that is in front of us. It's there. It's been articulated. So we do something different.
And the people in charge have got to be under control.
But we figure that we've made as great a contribution as anybody else. And that's why we get invited back a lot of times, you know. Don't you think so?
Oh, I don't know about that.
You've had a long career working together. You've been married since 1948. It's very hard for people in the entertainment business or performance, I think, to carry on a relationship and keep their performance careers up, in part because, especially as an actor, you have to go where the roles are. And, you know, you might have a role on one coast and your spouse on the other. What kinds of mechanisms have you come up with in your performance careers and relationships to make sure that you have time together and that, you know, your career and your relationship are going to work?
There's no guarantee, you know, from feeling like, well, you can't stand this another minute, you're going to divorce, the separation. You know, all the problems that face, all that, you know, what we say is not that we have some magic formula, but, oh, we hit upon something that, if you get past this problem to stay together another week, you got it made. Oh, hey, if you just get past this next week, well, we dealt with that problem before, so we know how to handle this again, you know. And I've long since, I've decided I'm not the only woman in the world that he's going to ever admire or love or think about being with, you know. But I know now he's not going to leave me, you know.
After all these years, you tell me that now.
And also marriage is like, marriage is an wedding, you have a wedding, that's a fact. But marriage is a continuing, growing process. Mm-hmm. And you marry on many, many levels over the years. Mm-hmm. And if you're married on more levels than you're not married on, then you can stand each other. And maybe you can grow to really love each other, you know. Mm-hmm. So you can really honestly say, oh, I really
might
wish
even
this
go further and even like each other.
Yeah, and even like each other mm-hmm. after a while. And then you discover, oh yeah, this is what they mean by loving somebody. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and it really doesn't belong between two people. Oh yeah, that quality belongs in a community. That quality belongs in a nation. We don't belong to ourselves really. We belong, you know. It's like a
we belong to belonging.
We belong to belong.
I think the truth of the matter is,
and he has a nice sense of humor too.
So have you. But the truth of the matter is that love is very important, but love can be so blinding that you can't really see the party to whom you are married. And then, luckily,
that's not love, though.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
When that kind of love cools down and you begin to see that the person you married is even more valuable than you thought, because you can deal with her on a different term in terms of who she is, rather than the degree to which she represents your fantasy or whatnot, which leads you into the marriage. But I think Ruby makes a point which I think is fundamental, and which is that pair bonding and man-woman relationship, marriage to some degree, is the natural state of affairs. It's biologically motivated. It's centered around the child, and nature's desire to protect the child creates the family. It is fundamental and basic. When we are in a situation where too many marriages are going on the rocks and things are happening, maybe we'd better look at the social relations and the economic relations and the political relations that keeps putting the squeeze on something which really should be natural and as easy as pie. We look upon ourselves and we say, my inclination is to be alone, or my inclination is to chase all the women. My inclination is to do this. Well, everybody has those kinds of inclinations. That's why we have fantasies and daydreams. We can get those things out of our system. Deeper than those surface inclinations is that basic commitment, biologically based, that two people should get together and form a union and a core. And out of that core comes the seed is developed for the next generation. So a sound marriage and people staying together is the most natural and normal thing in the world.
Yes, but how are you going to make the nurturing instinct commercial?
Well, I'm working on it, you know.
Well, with that, I want to wish you a happy anniversary again.
Why, thank you very much.
we're out of time. It's really been such a pleasure to have you here and to meet you. Thanks very much
for
coming to Fresh Air.
We do talk a lot.
I enjoyed it all. My guests have been Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, and they're both in Philadelphia today to be the guests of honor this evening at a 10th anniversary ball in celebration of the Miniversity. And the Miniversity is a community educational facility geared to adults, offering 12-week courses in Philadelphia. For information about the 10th anniversary tonight or the Miniversity in general, you can call 765-2815. That's 765-2815. Do you know when the Bill Moyers program that you're doing will be broadcast?
It's going to be on PBS, and I think it's going to be a series. And it will begin airing in March, I believe.
Yes, and we promise to let Dr. Sullivan and Grace Sullivan know about it as fast as we can get a straight, clear date. And then, yeah.
Great. Okay, well, I look forward to seeing it. And thanks again to both of you for being here.
Thank you, Terry.